I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. On today's show, the world is shifting towards green energy. Popular sentiment seems to be that fossil fuels are bad. So why then is OPEC more powerful than ever before? Going green is cool, but oil is still the orthodoxy. That's why Saudi Arabia, the de facto leader of OPEC, is more powerful now than just a year ago. Find out why next. All right, let's get into the MO. It began around 60 years ago. A group of energy-rich but otherwise relatively poor countries were just fed up with getting ripped off by wealthier Western nations for their main export, oil. So they decided to form a coalition. That group, now known as OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, the original founding five members consisted of Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, and the only non-Arab state of Venezuela. Now, over the last six decades, group membership has now grown to 13. The original five, along now with the UAE, Libya, Nigeria, Algeria, Angola, Gabon, Congo, and Equatorial Guinea. What's more, in 2016, the group has added plus to their alliance. OPEC Plus includes 11 cooperating states who are not official members, but largely and in effect act as such. Now, the biggest of the plus group, Russia. Russia is the world's third largest producer of petroleum, among other liquids, behind only Saudi Arabia and the United States. Now, this according to the BP Statistical Review of World Energy 2021 report. Russia produced some 10.8 million barrels per day that year and is classified as an upper middle income economy by the World Bank. Now, according to the OPEC annual statistical bulletin for 2022, the so-called cartel controls more than 80% of the world's proven oil reserves. A staggering 67% of that sits in the Middle East. But Venezuela, to the surprise of many, has about 3% more crude than the Saudis. So while the ultimate goal of the world claims to be going net zero, at present, oil literally greases the wheels for the entire world. But then OPEC roiled the West after U.S. President Joe Biden approached the Saudis about holding off on their 2 million barrel a day cut in production. He said hold off by 1 month, presumably until after the U.S. midterm elections. But then the Saudis, they just said nope. Now, also worth noting there, this was done in conjunction with Russia, who the G7 is aiming to punish with price caps on Russian crude. Now, Russia was considering a 1 million barrel a day cut, but Saudi Crown Prince MBS decided, no, let's just double that. So is that a signal the U.S.-Saudi relationship is souring? For more on OPEC and the growing power of Saudi Arabia, we invited someone who has served as an advisor to four, not one, not two, not three, four U.S. presidents on Mideast policy. Now, Bruce Rydell is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute Center for Middle East Policy and director at the Institute's Intelligence Project. Bruce, thank you for joining us. Now, many have described OPEC as a cartel. Is this a fair description of a group of nations who work together effectively, you know, as an oil cooperation council, especially since the term cartel is often associated with gangs and thugs and illegal activity and things like that?
I will leave it to specialists and lawyers to determine whether OPEC is technically a cartel. It is perceived to be a cartel, particularly in those countries which are the recipients of its oil. And the other thing I would say about its perception, OPEC is a collection of autocracies. In fact, a good deal of number of them absolute monarchies like Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. Most of its customers are democracies: the United States, Europe, India, Japan, Australia. So there is a perception that this is a collision between a bunch of autocrats and the democratic forces of the world. And that's not a perception that is in OPEC's advantage by any means.
So who or which country is the de facto leader of OPEC?
Saudi Arabia is the leader of OPEC, and it has been since the creation of the organization. Saudi Arabia provides at least a quarter, if not a third, of all the oil that OPEC produces. And it's the only country that has the capacity to increase production significantly or decrease production significantly, which gives it the key swivel rope in OPEC.
Now, Goldman Sachs commodities chief Jeff Currie seems to believe the group's power is at an all-time high of their, you know, roughly 60 years. Can you give us an example of the sheer power of this group? I mean, does it go beyond just shaping markets? Can it actually shape global politics?
I think as strong as OPEC is today, it's actually been stronger in the past. It was particularly stronger in the 1970s. 1973, of course, Saudi Arabia imposed the oil embargo. That led the Shah to quadruple oil prices. The Iranian Revolution led to a significant curtailment in oil that produced recessions. OPEC is strong and powerful today, but it's actually been even more powerful when more of the world was dependent upon it for its oil reserve, oil uses. The United States today produces much of its own oil. It is not as dependent as it was back in the 1970s.
The overthrown and murdered longtime leader of Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, he played an outsized role in shaping modern-day OPEC methodology. How would you describe his efforts? I mean, was he just sort of like a guy trying to unionize these mostly Arab oil-producing states, or would it be like something else?
Gaddafi was a true Arab nationalist. He believed that the solution to the Arab world was to unify all of the Arabs, as they say, from the ocean to the Gulf, from Morocco to Oman. Now, his quirky personality often got in the way of his political objectives, and he never did successfully unify Libya with any other country. But he certainly had a dream of a unified Arab world, which would dominate OPEC even more than the Arab world dominates it today.
Let's shift gears a little bit and place some focus on Saudi Arabia. Now, the U.S. relies heavily, I would say even primarily, on Saudi oil. The U.S. is Saudi Arabia's number one customer. Now, conversely, the Saudis are America's number one customer in the way of military arms. They buy up tens and tens of millions of dollars of hardware from the DoD, I would say almost every quarter, it seems. How would you characterize the U.S.-Saudi relationship? Is it a symbiotic one?
Well, the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States is very unequal. The United States provides Saudi Arabia with security, particularly against external foes. Without American support, Saudi Arabia would have been toppled by Nasser's Egypt in the 1950s, by Saddam Hussein in the 1990s. It would have been at the mercy of the Soviets. U.S. support has been crucial for the survival of the kingdom. This kingdom provides the United States with some of its oil, but the United States also produces a lot of its own oil and has increasingly gone to find new ways of developing oil. And if you look at the future, not the next 10 months, but the next 10 years, as climate change increasingly drives American politics and economics, we're going to be less and less reliant on fossil fuels. That's a good thing, but it also means we won't need the Saudis that much anymore. The Saudis, on the other hand, don't have an alternative to the United States for security. Clearly, Putin's Russia is not going to be able to provide security for anybody. It's losing the war in the Ukraine. And the Chinese aren't that interested in projecting power around the world and taking on security concerns. Neither Russia nor China is very much interested in taking on the Iranians, which is the Saudis' traditional foe. So the Saudis need America much more than America needs Saudi Arabia.
Can you elaborate a bit on the Brookings white paper that you released on this clandestine Saudi-Israeli relationship?
Saudi Arabia and Israel have had clandestine intelligence cooperation since the mid-1960s. In 1962, there was a coup in Yemen, in what was then North Yemen, that brought into power a pro-Soviet and pro-Egyptian Republican government. Both the Israelis and the Saudis wanted to support the alternative, the royalists. And the two of them cooperated in getting arms to the royalists. Literally, the Israeli Air Force flew down the Red Sea over Saudi territory and dropped arms to Yemeni royalist rebels. This collusion was the beginning. It has continued ever since then, and it continues to this day. It's been very successful for both sides. One of the reasons that the Israelis won so handedly the famous Six-Day War in 1967 is that the quagmire the Israelis and Saudis had created for the Egyptians in Yemen was bogging down 70,000 Egyptian soldiers. The best and brightest of the Egyptian army was in the wrong desert in June 1967. They were in the Yemen, they were not in the Sinai.
All right, so the term OPEC Plus, the plus, that actually includes Russia. What is Russia's position in this cartel? How important a player are they?
The Russians are not formally a member of OPEC, but they are a member of OPEC Plus. And as a very large oil producer, they have considerable weight. The war in Ukraine, though, has undermined their weight because there are so many countries that have applied sanctions against Russia and are not importing Russian oil anymore. So Russia's relative position has declined since it began the war with Ukraine, which is why Saudi Arabia's decision last month or earlier this month to cut production was so much to the Russians' advantage, because the Russians need to get as much money as they can for the amount of oil that they can find consumers for on the world market, mostly China and India. And even in China and India, they're selling oil at a bargain price. So pushing up the price of oil has been a significant help for the Russians in keeping their economy going in the face of the very expensive war they're fighting in the Ukraine.
Former presidential advisor Bruce Rydell, thank you so much for being with us today. And coming up next, we'll turn our focus onto Saudi Arabia and their growing strength beyond just their region of the world. We'll discuss it when we return. Sit tight. The MO will be right back.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Каратели из националистических батальонов, они сразу пришли на Донбасс убивать, пришли на Донбасс грабить, насиловать.
Это были пытки, это были очень жесткие допросы. То есть людей ломали конкретно.
Украинские националисты не воспринимали жителей Востока Украины в качестве полноценных украинцев.
Для чего они убили вот эту женщину, мою мать? Разве она жить не хотела? Хотела жить. Интересно, их мамы хотят жить?
Больше 90% пришло на референдум и проголосовало в поддержку Донецкой Народной Республики.
The Saudis have been an economic powerhouse in the Middle East for decades, but now, in a growing multipolar world, the Saudis are flexing their powers abroad. For more, we will bring in Ali Ahmed. He is a Saudi academic and journalist, founder of the Institute for Gulf Affairs. Ali, good to see you. So the U.S., you know, relies, I would say, a lot on Saudi oil. The Saudis also rely very heavily on the U.S. The Saudis are America's number one DOD customer. You know this. They buy up billions of dollars worth of arms. Huge contracts go to the Pentagon and affiliated companies. How would you describe the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia right now?
Well, while there is a lot of economic ties between Saudi Arabia and the United States, the primary market for Saudi Arabia is China in terms of exporting and importing goods, which makes the relationship sort of a bit odd. Yes, Saudi Arabia's number one source of arms and weaponry has been the United States. So, the United States sold more weapons to Saudi Arabia than any other country. And that explains a lot. And because the United States, the relationship has been, as stated even by many American presidents and officials, the United States is committed to the security and the survival of the Saudi monarchy over the past few decades. And most of that source is not the oil as claimed, because oil, Saudi oil in the United States is very minimal. But in terms of being a customer for American arms, Saudi Arabia is number one. And the Saudi government and the monarchy has spent a lot of money in Washington, in the United States in general, basically buying influence, be it in universities, media, reporters, politicians, past and current American officials on both sides of the aisle, in the Democratic side and the Republican side. In Congress and in government. So the relationship is definitely a symbiotic relationship, because you have a small group of people, that is the monarchy, or the those people who are now in control of the country among the monarchy, who require security and defense against first and foremost their own people. And the United States has provided that security and protection in spite of any denial. These are established facts that the United States stopped the overthrow or the removal of the monarchy from within that country, starting in the 1960s and continued until now. So it's not only against outside threats, but against their own people. In exchange, the Saudi monarchy has provided the United States government and officials with large contracts, opened the country airspace and land for U.S. to establish forward bases, and the Saudi monarchy also funded a lot of the American efforts in the region, in the Gulf and in the Middle East in general, be it in cash or in giving the United States bases so they can, for example, spy or attack countries in the region, from Yemen to Iraq to Iran to Syria. For example, Saudi Arabia provided a place to train Syrian rebels, ISIS-linked rebels in Saudi Arabia. You know, and this information is new, obviously, but these are facts. So over the past 6 years, Saudi Arabia served the United States security and economic goals, and the U.S. served the monarchy's survival and power within the country and in the region.
The Saudis have considered and seem to have agreed to start taking the Chinese yuan for oil. Now, if this really does happen, do you think this will be really destabilizing to markets, specifically here stateside? I mean, is this gonna cause the collapse of the U.S. petrodollar?
I do not think Saudi Arabia relying in part on the yuan will bring an end to the euro dollar, sort of to the petrodollar, but it will open the gateway to other countries to stop depending or using the dollar as a currency in international trade. Trades between China and Russia, for example, will stop using the dollar, and people dealing with China who are not, who are under sanctions or are bullied by the United States, like Venezuela and other countries, Cuba, you name it, will start dealing with China in their own currency. And that is, I think, a result of the United States sort of loose cannon policy of sanctioning countries and starving populations around the world. So people will go with the Chinese currency and deal with China rather than the United States to avoid U.S. sanctions and to stop being bullied. So I guess if the Saudi government is going to do it, it will be limited. It will not, it's not supposed to shake the market, but because these kind of markets are based on speculations and people inflating changes, there will be some losses. But I think in general, it would be a good step for international economics, because using a single currency as a main trading vehicle is not good. It limits options of many people. So it's important that the international economy uses different currencies, and it should be an open market. Isn't that supposed to be capitalism ideas, to have an open market or free market? So it would be good for the Saudis and for the Chinese, even I think for the Americans. But if they do it, of course, the United States will take this as a huge insult and a cause for revenge or steps. However, I think MBS will not do it until he is confident that this will not cause massive reaction. And I think that is explained by his recent sentencing of an American citizen to 16 years. This is the harshest sentence an American hostage has received ever. And the United States government basically did not react to this sentence and did not try anything to stop this from happening, although they had that information from last year, 11 months ago, yet they did not extend any effort or even ask the Saudi to free this 74-year-old man in any of the meetings between Secretary Blinken or Sullivan or Biden with the Saudi authority.
With the Saudis' consideration of taking in the Chinese yuan, does this signify a strengthening of their relationship with China, especially as Saudi Arabia is also considering application to the BRICS bloc?
The Saudi relationship with the Chinese have been growing, and now the number one trading partner for Saudi Arabia is China. In consumer goods, oil, energy, there are many projects in Saudi Arabia that are being built by Chinese companies. It's supposed to have been American companies, but again, people feel more comfortably, even those who are protected by the United States government, are finding dealing with the Chinese is easier and maybe even cheaper and better for them at the end. So it is very clear it has been happening for a while, and Saudi Arabia is expanding its investments in China and allowing the Chinese as well to bring a lot of economic projects into Saudi Arabia. This is not only limited to the economic projects, but also Saudi Arabia have purchased and Chinese military hardware, including service-to-service missiles. And there are Saudi military officers who are in training in China. So the United States now is not the only source for military hardware. It is still the primary source, and it will continue to be so, but the Chinese are also now a provider of arms to Saudi Arabia.
All right, we're going to have to leave that right there. My friend Ali Ahmed, always good to see you. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us this week. So while the Saudis lead the OPEC group, the collective West is also now considering a buyer's cartel of their own in response. Check that out. Not sure how that's all going to play out, but we'll have to wait and see. That's going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.